Okay, so today it's the first time I would present this work. Actually, it started because at Bloomberg they asked me a lot of things, like for instance to develop pricing models, but also even technical analysis or forecasting methods. And notoriously, it has a very bad reputation in the academic world. And so I tried to do something sort of maybe more scientific and to sort of try to justify, to substantiate the math behind. So I looked at a few properties, which I'm going to present now. So first point, it is that, okay, we do not trade precisely in continuous time, but virtually it's the case. If you look at an index here, it's the S&P 500. You have something over 15 years there. If you zoom over 1 week, you have this kind of things, and even over 1 hour, and those are real data, you have something which is virtually continuous time. So to simplify the whole presentation, we'll always assume continuous time and continuous prices. Also, it will help. But the main thing is that you have billions, maybe not millions of data if you go to the tick level. And obviously, it's impossible to handle all this. So one of the important questions is that if you want to simplify this information, how should you do? We will actually review the classical method, which is just what's called time-based. It means you sample at regular time interval, let's say 1 day or 12 minutes, like Yassine said. But we will essentially compare this method with what some people call the move-based. So it means you don't wait for 1 week to elapse, but more for the spot price to have moved by whatever, 3%, for instance. So we are going to see systematic comparisons. So we'll start with some theoretical results, and after we'll see some applications for delta hedging and volatility estimations, and also for technical analysis. So just we define what we are going to talk about. So the first thing is the time-based. So again, it's just the regular vertical slices. I remember I discussed this kind of things with Shiryaev, who is working on similar topics, and we kind of agreed of a nice definition, which is like Riemann integration as opposed to Lebesgue integration that you have on the move-based here. Move-based, it means that you define a certain set of price levels and you always wait to cross the next level, the level which is different from the current one. Or if you want, corresponds to readjust a sort of centered interval. Every time you exit it, you recenter on this one. So we'll see different properties of those things. Just to give you an example on one precise path, so you have the green approximation. I'm doing something that may look a bit strange, but it's to simplify the analysis. I will associate with those discretization points an approximation which is just piecewise constant. So basically, if you start from a martingale, so you retain martingality, these kind of things, which is not the case with a piecewise linear function. So the green one, it's based on regular time steps, and you see that it's not capturing, for instance, this peak here. Move-based is the red approximation. So again, you wait for the first time that you hit a level different from the last one. And you see that it's kind of capturing the peak here. It will sample more finely when it's needed. So it's a bit linked to this change of time, or the DDS time change, the Dombis-Dubin-Schwarz. So which means that if you have more activity, then you change the clock. I think Elliot also has been working on this kind of things, showing that if you change the clock, then you're back to Gaussian increments. So here we see that it looks better in general to use the red line instead of a blind delta t. So we are trying to look at quite a few properties of this. So something which is obvious is if you're paying attention to approximation properties in terms of the L infinite norm, so for one given path, if you refine the delta t, Elliot, that may be the difference between somebody who takes a plane and somebody who does not.
Time-based.
Speeding the time down.
Waiting for me.
Okay. So obviously, on one given path, if you refine the delta t as your path was continuous, it will the L infinite norm of the difference between the continuous path and the discrete approximation will converge to zero, but it's not uniform over the set of paths. For any small delta t, you may find a path that will have huge increment. So it's just an expectation you would have some convergence result. Indeed, by construction, the move-based strategy approximation is always less than alpha away, if alpha is the length, the interval, the distance between two rungs. So that's kind of nice. For instance, if you know the sequence of ups and downs up to a certain time, then you know up to alpha where you are. You have an interesting LP convergence. I don't know whether those results are. Yeah, they must be known. I don't know. Yeah, it's a good person to ask. It's not very deep. So yeah, quite a few things I've been doing, like this LP convergence. It was with an intern whose name is Jean-Damien Artarit from Polytechnique. So convergence properties we have, it is that the versions of all orders, because we didn't say that it was a martingale path, so we don't know whether it's quadratic version, which is about finite or whatever, but whether it be pathwise time-based or move-based, they will all converge. The idea is that indeed time-based, when you refine delta t, when it goes to zero, the sequence of points becomes denser, and by definition, all the variations are converging. For the move-based, it's a bit tricky. You just have first to take away the flat bits in your path, and the variation of the sort of simplified path will be the same one as the initial one, and then you show after that the sequence of dates are dense and are okay. What is more interesting, I'm sorry, there is a typo here, and I guess later as well. In the time-based equation, it's a sigma square in the integral, but not in the other one, actually. That's, again, it has been mentioned by Yassine, I think, yesterday. It's results that are due to Jacod and the Jacod and Prater, 94 and 98. So essentially it tells you that if you have a diffusion process like this and you try to evaluate, to estimate the quadratic variation by taking regular delta t intervals, the error essentially behaves like an independent Brownian motion or a stochastic integral here. So mainly the idea is that over a small time increment, the process has a Brownian increment, and the quadratic version will be the square of it. And when you look at the correlation between a Gaussian increment and the square of it, actually it is zero. So essentially the increments will be ID, and the fact that they are decorrelated shows you that you can write it like this. For the move-based, first let's imagine that, for instance, it's purely a Brownian motion, so sigma is equal to 1. So you have to understand that alpha will have to be of the order of a square root of delta t if you want to retain, in average, the same number of crossing of discretization points. Otherwise, it should be, if you have volatility, it should be sigma square root delta t. So the interesting result here is that we have something that looks pretty much the same, except that the two points. First, the variance coefficient, sorry, the coefficient in front is lesser. It's due to the fact that the instantaneous variance of the tracking errors, actually it's divided by three when you use this move-based as opposed to time-based. And the second thing is that you have a sigma instead of a sigma square. Obviously, to scale things properly, it means that you should have more, mainly another sigma there in the alpha. But this tells you that it will behave much better than the time-based if you have, let's say, an instantaneous volatility which is highly variable. It's a direct application of Cauchy-Schwarz inequality that shows you that you will have a better approximation result. So up to my knowledge, the time-based result has been known for over 10 years, and the move-based result is new, but maybe you can tell me. Some variations about this, because so far we were dealing just with a quadratic variation. So we had a diffusion, but it was corresponding to the delta hedging, actually, of a simple product, which was parabolic, as Anthony and myself, we know, we've been working on this for 15 years, something like that. Now we do something a bit more complicated. We look at the tracking error when you delta hedge a European option. Here we don't do anything fancy, like trying to find how to adjust the optimal delta when you have discrete time hedging. No, what you do is just something simple, which is you, at a trading time, then you blindly take your model delta in it. I've taken in this case diffusion, something like a local vol, just to make sure that you have a well-defined price and hedging parameter. So again, you have the same thing. I'm sorry, you have squares again on the top one, but not on the second one. So you have those two facts. One, that the constant is better with a move-based. And the second thing, which is that it's sort of dampening the effect of varying volatility. Yes?
In the previous slide, you had a sigma squared dB.
Yeah, it's what I said. There is a typo. It should be a sigma square on the top one, but
DS.
Not on the...
But it's sigma squared dS.
No, it's dB. Yeah, it's something we've seen with Yassin yesterday. It's due... Because again, the error, if you look at the tracking error through time, so every day or every hour you rehedge, and you're going to add up independent small errors. And each one is not at all a Gaussian increment. Actually, it's a chi squared, the square of it but minus the expectation. And so what it tells you is that you have this equality in low. If you just make a Monte Carlo simulation, for instance, you will see that your tracking error will pretty much evolve like a Brownian motion and or like a diffusion, and you can make it more precise like this. And it is a sigma square because it's linked to the variance of a chi squared, which is of the order of a sigma to the fourth, as opposed.
But I'm pretty sure it's dS, not.
No, it's dB, definitely. I can tell you it's dB. I don't know whether anyone knows this kind of results. Yeah, it's dB. dB. and sigma square. Yeah. Now, again, this is the interesting thing. It's, you start from one Brownian motion, and there is no other source of randomness. But when you add up the tracking errors, it creates a Brownian motion, which is independent from the former one. You would have the same thing actually with higher order. It's linked also to Wiener chaos or Hermit martingales, and you can from. But it's a bit out of the topic. And this gives you actually so estimates of the variance of the tracking error. Here, what you're doing, it's you look at one given pass. and you look at what happens of, for the tracking error when delta t goes to zero. I mean, for one fixed delta t, you see when time goes by, your tracking error is again behaving like a diffusion because you add up independent small bits. I see at least it's interesting. Good. yeah, so this is the same thing with the same typos, which is very bad. And here there is an interesting result. It's something I derived because I wanted to link this to the estimate of volatility. So, okay, you have a continuous martingale starting at zero, and you look at the move based. So, and you call tau I the date of the ith crossing. And so, if you have a time interval, you will pay attention to the number of crossings, and which I call L of alpha and t. So, it depends on the spacing between the rungs and the maturity. So, it's the number of readjustments. And by working a little bit, you have something which is eventually very interesting, which is that expected length, accepted number of crossings, is essentially this guy. I mean, as you will be in between two crossings, you have this thing here, but essentially it behaves like this. I thought it was a new result until I realized that you could get it from Dube's result on up crossings and down crossings if you repeat this for all the possible rungs. I don't know, we have plenty of stochasticians so here, so I don't know, Mark or Chris, do you know whether this is...
So it's kind of obvious, but I don't know.
My last chance to get a train, a plane. No, but you have to be careful. You may think, for instance, if it's a constant volatility, you may think, oh yeah, actually it's not at all surprising because the expected time for Brownian motion of the exit time, it's alpha squared. So you may think, oh, if it takes an average alpha squared between two cross times, then I have this. But okay, it takes a little bit of time, but it's quite interesting. It's far from obvious. Let's say you have a phone booth with plenty of people queuing to place phones, and you know that in average each phone call takes 1 minute. Now the question is, does it mean that in 1 hour in average you have 60 calls? It's tempting to say this, but actually it's tricky. It depends on when you start. So if you start at a random time and you count the number of calls, or actually of clicks, I mean end of call for instance, then you will get 60 in average. But if you start at the beginning of a call, usually you will get more. For instance, imagine that you have plenty of calls of 1 second and a few that are 1 hour. If you take a random time, so most of the time you will fall into a long call and you will get zero clicks, and sometimes you will cover at the end of a click and you will get click, 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 plenty of them. In average, it will be 60. But if you start at the beginning, if you assume that everything's ID in general, you will get plenty of them. We'll get click, 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 much more than 60. And here, it's not obvious because it corresponds to a case where you're starting at a click and so on. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the difference of obviousness and not is my limitations. okay, another. Actually, I'm not going to comment much on this. But when we developed this kind of methods of recoding paths through the crossing, we had to do it sometimes forward, other times backward. And somebody asked, but are you always getting the same sequence of up and downs, actually. And there is a decomposition, canonical decomposition of paths, which can be quite interesting. It's if you have a continuous path like this, actually you can define an alternating sequence of bridges and meanders. Now I define here a bridge like being an interval that starts on one given price level and at the same one without crossing another level in between. And it's a maximal one that does this. A meander goes from one level to the next one, to a different one, without crossing any other level in between. For Brownian motion, you sort of spend two-thirds of the time actually in the bridges and the meanders. Actually, I'm just mentioning this because it shows that the forward and the backward the constructions are equivalent, but it's not a nothing deep. So now, about a hedging. So usually when we deal with discrete time hedging, it's notably due to the presence of transaction cost, and you have plenty of different models corresponding to different assumptions on the nature of them, whether they are constant, proportional, affine, nonlinear, whatever. And usually, so it's solved with HJB tools. And here I'm going to sort of simplify really the problem. So I simplify first the dynamics. I simplify the problem to have a well-defined answer, actually. So I simplify the dynamics. I just have Bachelier dynamics, so arithmetic Brownian motion, no rates. I take an option which will have a constant gamma, so not to be disturbed by this effect. So again, it corresponds to the hedging of a parabolic profile. And what I will impose, it's to have the average time between two rehedges that will be imposed. So it means more or less the average number of hedges over the time period will be fixed. So the problem is to know what is the optimal rehedge stopping rule in this case. First, so I take something very simple. It's actually it's even normalized volatility, so it's just a Brownian motion, and your contingent claim will just give you the square of the Brownian motion at time t, and so the value of this at time small t. So it's just an intrinsic plus time value, which is just a residual time in this case. So your problem is to decide when to rehedge. So if you do it at some stopping time tau, so you know that indeed in expectation the tracking error will be zero. What you would like to do is to minimize the variance of the tracking error and to normalize things conveniently. Let's say we may say that expected time of a rehedge is one, or it would be more convenient actually not to normal to impose constraint on tau and just trying to minimize this ratio. Or let's say the square of the ratio will be easier. But to understand what happens, so you start from this thing here. So you're running, your spot price is evolving, and if you decide, for instance, to rehedge here, then you're going to lose money. The P&L here will be zero, the break-even points are here, plus and minus a square root. So it means that you have not made and lost money. You make money here, you lose money there. But again, you know that in average it's zero, so your target is not to make money, but to reduce the variance. You know that the section at a constant time here, so it will be just a classical trader's graph of a parabola. I think I have it after. Here, yeah, that's it. So it's this thing. So you make money thanks to the gamma, but you lose money because of the theta of the time value, the time you spent. So this, for the time based, what you have, it's this. So essentially, it will be a chi-squared because this is Brownian. And when you do the move based, actually, in this case, so you know in advance what it will be. This will be alpha squared, and the tau has a density like this. So you know the one-sided density has an expected infinite expected time, but the doubly bounded one is finite. So sorry, yeah, what I should mention is when you look at the value of the what I call the ratio, or rather the ratio squared before, which is the for the variance minimization, the time-based gives a number which is 2. And this one here gives 2/3. So we think, oh, for a first attempt, it's much better. But indeed, what we would like to do in this simplified problem model is to find the optimal one. So you may think, oh, actually, if I carry on a lot, you know, I was losing a lot of time value, so maybe it's better to truncate it here. Or maybe, and so you try this for any level of truncation, and actually you see that it's always worse than the 2/3 you get through the time-based, the exit from a corridor. So after you think, oh wait, actually, if I manage to stop exactly on just the break-even points here, it's wonderful. I have a perfect replication, have zero tracking error. The problem is that it's a square root, so if you do it, actually you hit immediately. So you may think, maybe I take some leeway around and I have a different region like this, and when I exit it, I re-hedge, because then I'm sure that I never have a big tracking error. All those things are actually not working any better than the time, the move based. So I will ask Chris, who likes obvious problems, so what he thinks the optimal stopping rule would be. Or anyone. Oh, Steve. Or David, I don't want to make any people angry, so I should. I'm not going to quote the half the. Yeah. Okay. So the thing is that I did something terrible, which is facilitated by the modern technology, and I really admire the mathematicians who really had to think instead of trying. But I tried things like, for instance, going back to the move-based strategy. Just to see what happens if you sort of do little perturbations of your corridor here, to see whether it improves or not, or shrinking, and whatever I was trying, it was worse. So I conjectured that actually the solution was the move based, that it was really a kind of strong result of the optimality, and actually it's my young intern who solved it. So essentially, by there are different ways actually we can simplify it, but essentially it was by a couple of Itô manipulations. He was able to show that you could reformulate it like this, and once you've done that, it's quite easy, because you need to minimize this when you know if you've imposed the expected value of stopping time, it corresponds to to this. So your problem is actually to minimize the kurtosis, and you know that it's achieved thanks to Cauchy-Schwarz inequality when it's a binomial distribution, and we know that the only possible way to achieve this, to stop Brown motion to get this, is the is exactly this one. Actually, it works as well if you take a strict one, but does not happen often. Okay, here it's a very short slide, but first, what we've seen before, really, I judge it a kind of strong result, because it establishes something which is not surprising, but that, what is clear is that the delta t method indeed is not a very good one. It's a sort of a dumb one, because you're not even looking at what happened. So obviously cannot be the best one. And it's much better to have something which is, for instance, move-based. But in general, it's not optimal. It will depend on the gamma of the option. And better rules would be when the delta of the option is moved by some factor, and you have even finer results. But what is very nice is that in the simple case of this, let's say, variance swap. I mean, it could be applied, for instance, if you have a variance swap over the year. So it means you're supposed to replicate the sum of the daily square of returns, but you just want to hedge, 10 times. So when should you rehedge? So this gives you the answer. So it's quite good. All this has some links with something I call the business time delta hedge, which is actually something I inspected when I did some recent work on the volatility, the derivatives, which was linked actually to the Skarrad embedding problem. Maybe I start with just very few comments. It's a very important problem, and we have Jan Obloch, who has written a wonderful survey on the history of the Skarrad embedding problem, so listing 21 known solutions of it. And it's chronological, so it's like a thriller. It's quite fascinating. And why is it relevant to finance? Yeah, first, what is it? It's you have a target density, and you want to stop a Brownian motion, such a way that a stopped Brownian motion has that law. And you impose also expected finite expectation of stopping time. So the very interesting thing is that you have a kind of mapping between the solutions of the Skarrad embedding problem and the set, the processes that would generate the European option prices of one maturity, actually. It's through the DDS stuff. So it means that those 21 solutions of the Skarrad embedding problem are going to give you 21 different prices in general for the pricing of some exotics. You know, it's a fundamental problem in finance to know in which sense the knowledge of the European options is imposing some constraints on the value of exotics. David has been spending half of his life, I think, on that, so he knows it very well. Actually, a tool which is very important in all this is the representation of local martingales as time-changed Brownian motion. And it looks very abstract, but for traders, it's very interesting because a classical interview question is the following one. Let's say you know in advance that a realized volatility over the year is going to be less than 20%, and you can sell an option for 30% Black-Scholes implied volatility. Is it a good idea? I mean, if you sell the option, collect the premium and the hedge with whatever 20 or 30% volatility, I mean, delta computed on this or anything in between, are you sure to make money? So many people say, oh yeah, the volatility is conservative, so it's okay. But obviously, you know that if it doesn't move a lot and it moves a lot close to maturity, close to the strike, so you have this exploding gamma, and so you can lose immensely, actually, much more than the initial premium. So you have to be careful in general, but if you perform this time change, actually, you will be sure that you will make money. If you were right on your initial estimate of the volatility, then by correcting the delta hedge, which means that mostly instead of having a variance parameter which is linearly decreasing through time, like what you have in Black-Scholes, actually it will decrease at a speed that depends on the realized quadratic variation. If it has moved a lot, it will do something like that. So a good way to look at it, it's like having an energy reserve that you're going to consume along the replication. Or if you want, you put some gasoline in your tank, and the maturity corresponds to a certain destination, and you're going to see whether you manage to reach the destination or not. This will depend on how fast you did consume it. And in my example, if it has not moved a lot to start with, so it means I've not consumed much gasoline, and so it means that I'm still pricing and hedging the option with a high volatility, which absorbs this Dirac gamma. I'm afraid I have a double constraint on the time of the talk and the plane. I have to speed up. Sorry. So now I go quickly through how it's possible to utilize this in technical analysis. I mean, precise applications of this, it can be either in volatility estimation, and whether it be for delta T or delta S, time-based or move-based, what you can do is compute, estimate volatilities at different scales. You know that for a Brownian motion, it would scale along a certain rule. And if you see that it's not, for processes with independent increments in general, and if you see that it does not obey this rule on the market, actually, you can have sort of arbitrage strategies, and that will not even involve any option trading. It would be just a trading strategy on the spot. I just give you an example for the time-based. If you see that systematically the daily vol is much higher than the weekly vol, then when you look at the associated strategy, essentially it corresponds to play the mean reversion over each week. On the Monday, you set a reference level. If the spot goes above, you sell. If below, you buy, proportionally to the distance to the reference level. And the Monday after, you set a new reference level and you carry on the same thing. You have something equivalent for the move-based, and the Shiryaev has written things on it. So technical analysis in 7 minutes. Okay, so normally it's forbidden to talk about this kind of topic in an academy. I could be banned, so that's why I try to put some varnish around it. But essentially, economic theory tells you that you have a random walk, whatever happened before, I don't care, it's a fair game, it's like this. Now technical analysis says, no, there are regularity, it's a community of thousands of people interacting every day, they are not inventing orthogonal rules every time, so there are some repetitions, and you just have to be able to find them. So like pattern recognition, extracting some indicators, and if you find a proper one, maybe you will have something imbalanced like this. So you need to identify patterns and predict from patterns. First thing we are going to do is to try to look at a good way to code the information contained in the recent past. Actually, I happened, it was almost 20 years ago, to introduce neural networks methodology into finance, time series forecasting. It was in 87, 88. And I was working cognitive science, was a totally different jargon. And it was very interesting, but one of the problems, it was due to the fact that, like most of the people after, I was already sort of using a fixed delta t, which means you vectorize the information in a sort of a dumb way. For instance, if you have a time window of 2 weeks, 10 daily closes, so it means it's 10 returns, say, and so it's one point in the dimension 10. But if you had, let's say, taken away one return and do the rest, and the pattern globally would not have changed much, but it would have been sent in a totally different region of the space, because you would have shifted all the coordinates, actually. So obviously, if you tried to isolate kind of clouds, regions of the space that may have some predictive power, you first have to do sort of better filtering to start with, and actually the binary coding based on this move-based is a very good one. So it's something you've seen before here. So the point is that I'm just going to keep track. If nothing happens, I just discard it. So I just keep track of those points here. And furthermore, I even ignore time. So I just do something very simple, which is keeping the sequence of ups and downs. So like, it's binary coding. It's, if you want, it's an MP3 of a financial market, if you want. So if you have something like this, so let's say you say it's a 1 if it goes up, a 0 if it goes down, and you just keep this and discarding the precise timing. So this is a way to sort of simplify the recent past. And okay, those are properties that I mentioned in the first part of the talk. This is something which was aimed at clients, so they like funny things. Like you have a DNA sequence, and you have some junk, and something that gene here. So you're trying to find a signal in the noise, which has some functionality. And here it would be the same thing. You would have some garbage. And you try to find a subsequence which would have some predictive power, which means that if you realize that in the past it was sort of systematically followed by one, then you would guess that it's a good indicator and you should buy. So how does it work? 3 minutes. First thing, okay, so we code the recent past with a given string, and after we scanned the past to have a long screen and we look at the string, and we are looking for substrings in the past that looked like the current one. So the idea is really to try, if ever there's something to be read in the past, to have a scientific method to systematically screen, scan what happened, and to test the predictive power. And again, our belief and experience is that it's better when you discard periods where nothing much was happening. So this binary strings is a good way beyond all the optimal properties I showed before. So what do? You identify the similar strings, or you may be more selective and say, I want a perfect match. But in general, it's good also to interview not only the perfect matches, but a second best. So we have different ways to do this. And you will inspect the bits that followed those subsequences in the past, and you will average that to get an indicator of, let's say, it will be actually the probability that goes up or down. I mean, you will compute an empirical probability, and you will assume that it has some possibility of carrying on like this. And you convert the signal into a certain trading rule. So distance between strings. So let's say if the current string is this one, that the last bit, and going a bit backward, if you have two other strings in the past that were looking very much the same, they both differ just by one bit from A. But actually, you will consider that B is close to A and C maybe is not. Why? Because actually, the differing bit here is just a remote one. But those 5 bits here are exactly matching. So you consider that they are close. But here, it's only one differing bit between C and A, but it's the last one. So that's that's a bad sign. So obviously, you would like to define a distance, for instance, like this, where you have a weighting scheme here that here we take a simple exponential one that controls the decay. Actually, we work with a long string, and the decaying function is sort of automatically performing the truncation, so we do not have to define both the lengths and the decay. After, we are performing actually some non-parametric estimation, which is that, okay, if this is a string from the past, which has been followed by this up move here, then, so what we are doing? We are, again, we're scanning the past, and we'll take a sort of average of these following bits with a weight that will depend on the distance of that string to the current one. So if you want, each past string will vote for the successor, it will vote in favor of its own candidate, which was this one, with a weight which is given by something like this. So it's like a kind of exponential or kernel here. And after the last component, trading strategies, or something very classical, if you have a trading signal here, you're going to say, okay, if it's a 52% of chances of going up, I'm not going to really intervene here. And I need to filter this out. I may decide that I will load the position according to the intensity of the signal. But to do something very simple here, we decide that if the signal is in between, you don't do anything. If it's above, you buy. If it's below, you sell. And you may either add up different positions or wait for one position to unwind to place the next one. To unwind, it's obviously when you get out of the exit. I mean, for instance, if your ranks are 2% apart, so you would enter a deal, a trade, if your signal is high, and you will wait to go plus or 2 minus 2%, plus or minus 2% to exit. So accordingly. So just very quickly to conclude, it's some examples. I mean, other interesting properties. Here we've seen that actually it gives the probability of up or down after for the next step, but you can carry on over longer, like when you play chess, over several shots in the future. Actually, conceptually, it's interesting to see that this tool is systematically scanning the past and extracting, I mean, conditioning the future and actually a measure on future paths, on future strings through this mechanism. We identify, for instance, different sequences of binary strings here that have proven in the past to have a very strong predictive power. And here, I think, the way we do it, it's very simple, and actually it's too simple, and we've not frozen actually the best parameter. And we should sort of let them free for people to work with. Essentially, you need, you define over which, what is the period of training and the spacing between the rungs, and when you buy and when you sell, so the filter and position size. But two other important parameters which are not accessible currently, it is the exponential weighting, I mean the definition of the distance and how the distance impact the weight in the voting scheme. So different outputs that you have. So it's something that is here, I think it was S&P 500, and here it tells you when it starts selling position and here buying position. That's the net exposure through time. So here it's just a repeat of the top one of the S&P 500, to just a buy and hold strategy. And this is an example here of what it's doing when it when you follow the P&L evolution, when you follow the strategy. So in summary, so it screens the past and it's in a compact encoding to check sort of a deviation from martingality. You use a non-parametric estimation to get the estimate of the next bit, and it's opportunistic and not dogmatic in the sense that you don't need. I mean, most of the technical analysis methods are sort of just expressing a strong belief that markets are trending or mean reverting, and they adapt this. Here we are just sort of screening the data and establishing a catalog of patterns that have proven to have a predictive power in the past. So obviously it's no guarantee it will work in the future. But let's say we try to put some order in a very messy field. Thank you.
Time for a quick question or two.
About your distance between strings, if you've got the same pattern but at a slightly different scale, don't you say they're quite different? There's quite different patterns.
Scale? You mean that it was with different spacing between the rungs?
Yeah, not in timing, but in size. You know, instead of being a 0.5% move, it was 1% move.
Actually, we do not cross the information between two different. I mean, here we start by deciding on one spacing. And everything is conducted there. We could have a sort of multi-scale method and to try to cross the information and the patterns between different ones. But the best thing it's rather to do your own scaling and to do it on the logs or to rescale by the volatility you had at the time. I think it's better to put your own rule first instead of crossing all the possible combinations. Okay. Allez, okay.
Post simulations and did you use high frequency data to make sure that your strategies are not anticipating?
We know that it's not anticipating. We've tested on Brown and Motion, but it's a good point in the sense that it's very easy when you construct this kind of methods to think that you've done the thing properly, but actually, if we had a problem at some stage with when we had different lengths, and actually we had amazing results, and it was using the some condition. No, we checked, we screened everything very thoroughly, and I can guarantee you there is no bias in this. The simulations you see are kind of simplified because we are not actually taking interest rate into account or bid offer, but the positions were sort of quite well balanced between buying and selling, and we've done it also on a lab environment, and it was not really affecting the thing.
Can you be sure that you have not missed intervention points which have occurred in reality? So ex post simulations.
What do you mean, a strategic good time to invest? Oh yeah, indeed, we miss plenty of them. But here, I'm fair by showing the evolution of the P&L. Everybody working in technical analysis, they will tell you, oh, look at this, what happened on that day. My method was exactly, swing heads and shoulders. And on a very few selected example, and if you look at the data, you say, but here it was exactly the same, and it went down, so as it's something more scientific here. I've been sort of careful to show something which is unbiased in the method and unbiased in the results as well, to show full history.
Well, I have just two comments, maybe not questions. More. Well, I'm of course grateful for energizing my survey, even though I did not intend it to be a thriller, I have to say. But if we could go back to the your equality, saying that expectation of square of the Brownian motion minus square Brownian motion minus stopping time is equal to 2/3 of Brownian motion fourth.
I'm sorry, those things here? Or?
The one that
okay, sorry.
I was just, Chris pointing some obvious things before, so I was just thought I might point out that it is obvious as well.
This one, I guess.
Yeah, so actually, this one is just, if you take the martingale, it's based on the fourth Hermite polynomial. It tells you that bt to the 4 minus 6 times bt squared times t plus 3 times t squared is martingale. You divide it by 3, you subtract, and you get it for all stopping times.
Actually, it's one of the alternative derivations, absolutely. Another way to look at it is to say that w squared minus tau, it's twice the integral of w dw, and when you square it, you have a different method. I mean, once you know the results, it's always easier. I mean, if you know you have to go through that, it's easier. I had just asked a few people, not deeply, and nobody could give me a straight answer. But I would say the result is kind of really surprising, because a trader would say it makes sense to follow the break-even points to have a stopping region which is adapted to the geometry of the problem, and actually, no, it's better to do the simple thing. Well, okay. why do I have more questions?
One quick question, one quick answer.
Could you please show the slide where you had this approximation result? Y minus Y approximation tends to something. One of the first ones.
Yeah, it's probably, like for instance,
here, one. Shouldn't there be the integral on the left-hand side, under the limit? The integral error.
Here, it is...
in the upper line.
This here, for instance?
The upper one.
It's an error between the quadratic versions of the continuous process and of the discrete approximation. And it's a... between 0 and time t. And the error, the tracking error between 0 and time t, is an integral on the right-hand side.
But there also exists a similar result for the integral error. The integral between the integral of y minus the integral of approximation.
We really pay attention to the... it's an error of the quadratic version, so it's already the... we are not looking at the L1, if you want, error. I have the LP results as well. What I'm doing here, it's really when I try to
replicate the quadratic version of the continuous process with this discrete approximation with a zero error. So again, it is the have a square on the first line.
Right, well, let's thank Bruno once again.